About in the middle of the minor prophets in the Old Testament. Is anyone kind of warm other than me? Me and Mike, that's enough.
Outnumbered?
Okay. Micah has seven chapters. We're beginning the seventh chapter this morning. We'll have about the first half of the chapter this morning, and John will finish the second half and the book of Micah next week, and then we'll move on. We've been 10 weeks in the book of Micah, which, of course, it's a short book, but for most of the books that we went through, it's a short time as well. Micah chapter 7, let's read the first 13 verses to begin with. First of all, let me point out something just about, if you have an outline there, you see I've entitled the message, Spitting in the Wind. That's a phrase that we kind of hear occasionally, and it speaks to the futility of trying to do something. And the wind is blowing at you, and you end up getting spitting on yourself. The wind is strong enough, and the idea being that it is not just futile, it's not just useless, it's sort of nasty, maybe. And think of that along those lines as we read through the first 13 verses of Micah chapter 7. Micah says, "Woe is me, for I am like the fruit pickers and the grape gatherers. There is not a cluster of grapes to eat, or first ripe fig which I crave. The godly person has perished from the land, and there is no upright person among men. All of them lie in wait for bloodshed. Each of them hunts the other with a net. Concerning evil, both hands do it well. The prince asks also the judge for a bribe, and a great man speaks the desire of his soul, so they weave it together. The best of them is like a briar, the most upright like a thorn hedge. The day when you post a watchman, your punishment will come. Then their confusion will occur. Do not trust in a neighbor. Do not have confidence in a friend. From her who lies in your bosom, guard your lips. For son treats father contemptuously. Daughter rises up against her mother. Daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies are the men of his own household. But as for me, I will watch expectantly for the Lord. I will wait for the God of my salvation. My God will hear me. Do not rejoice over me, my enemy. Though I fall, I will rise. Though I dwell in darkness, the Lord is a light for me. I will bear the indignation of the Lord because I have sinned against him, until he pleads my case and executes justice for me. He will bring me out to the light, and I will see his righteousness. Then my enemy will see, and shame will cover her who said to me, 'Where is the Lord your God?' My eyes will look on her. At that time she will be trampled down like mire of the streets. It will be a day for building your walls. On that day will your border be extended. It will be a day when they will come to you from Assyria and the cities of Egypt, from Egypt even to the Euphrates, from sea to sea and mountain to mountain. And the earth will become desolate because of her inhabitants on account of the fruit of their deeds." And we'll stop there for this morning. I want to use three phrases. These will be the 3 points on the outline. Three phrases that we probably have all said in our life a number of times. They're sort of very common, sort of loosely spoken at times, and build our points around these. The first one is this: what's the use? Have you ever said that before? What's the use? Something is going on in your life and you're trying to accomplish something, you're trying to do something, and things aren't working out at all, and you finally just throw up your hands in exasperation and say, what's the use? Why bother? Why try? And it seems like that Micah almost has reached that point. If you've been with us, you've seen Micah and as the previous chapters as he prophesied against his own people. His own people were in dire straits and on the very verge of being taken over by the Assyrians. And they're going through some difficult times, and yet it seems like that they have no care for the predicament they're in other than to get themselves some physical relief. They don't make the connection, it seems, between the predicament they are in and their relationship to God. And Micah is prophesying and preaching against their leaders. He's prophesying against the people who are taking advantage of one another. He's prophesying against their religious leaders as well, not just their government leaders. And he unloads on them. And we come to chapter 7, and it seems like he is not winding down necessarily, but it seems like that Micah is perhaps looking around him and trying to see, what have I accomplished? And he begins with these three words, woe is me. Now remember, we talked about the prophet's message. The prophet either came with good news or bad news. If he came with good news, that was called an oracle of weal, W-E-A-L. And usually that message, that good news, would be preceded by the word blessed. Blessed be such and such. If the prophet came with bad news, usually that was called an oracle of woe, and usually that message was preceded with the word woe. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. You remember Jesus saying as a prophet in the New Testament. Here Micah says, woe is me. He's not talking now about the religious leaders. He's not talking about the officials. He's not talking about the people. He has this woe directed inward, directed at himself. Woe is me. Why is that, do you think? There are two or three things that I want to mention, and only one of them you can see a hint of in the text. But the first one is this, that no prophet that I would imagine would get pleasure out of speaking the way Micah has been speaking. No prophet gets great pleasure out of just condemning his fellow countrymen. No prophet gets pleasure out of just speaking a hard truth and confronting people with their evil. And we experience that not as a prophet necessarily as Micah, but just as a parent or as a fellow church member or whatever, when someone is being offensive, don't you find it difficult to rebuke them? Difficult to confront them? We do everything we possibly can to avoid it. Sometimes to our detriment. And it's difficult. There's no pleasure in being confrontational. And I'm sure Micah has experienced that. But secondly, another thing is that Micah is going to himself experience the very judgments that he has promised is coming. Micah is not going to be exempt from the hard times that come to his people. When the Assyrians come in and take over the land, they're not going to take over everything except Micah. If they lay siege around the city and starve them out, Micah will get hungry just like everyone else. Micah will experience the judgments just as well as the people. And those two things, I think, are in Micah's mind, but I don't think that is the primary one. The primary one, I think, is Micah's question, who is listening? Is anybody hearing what I'm saying? You see in verse 1, he says, I'm like the fruit pickers. And I'm like the grape gatherers. They go to the vineyard, and there are no grapes on the vine. They go to the fig tree, there's no figs on the tree. It's like, he says, like that when I prophesy, it's like that when I preach, no one is listening. No one cares. I heard not long ago, and I can't remember exactly where I heard it, but someone made the statement, they were talking about preachers who were, well, actually it was a preacher who had left the ministry who was saying this. He said, one of the greatest fears that a preacher has is being irrelevant, is of pouring his heart into a people and it seems that nobody is listening. Nobody cares. And it seems that that's the way Micah is. Micah said, I'm like the grape gatherers. They go to the vineyard and there's no grapes on the vines. There's no figs on the tree. I preach and I pour out God's message and my passion to the people and no one is responding. No one cares. Well, exactly, that is verse 1. Exactly how that he describes that we see in verses 2 through 6. Let's look at first at verse 2. The godly person has perished from the land, and there is no upright person among men. There is an absence of righteous people. I've got a sister who has taught in public school for a number of years, and this year she's the principal at the middle school at Heber. And we was having a conversation the other day, and this is not the first incident that I've heard like this. I've been hearing things like this for 30 or 40 years. But the way that this is not just that arena, it's other arenas as well. But when I was a kid in school, the teachers could make you mind. They could get your attention without fear of parents suing them, without fear of all of these things of violating someone's rights and all this kind of stuff. They could get your attention. But nowadays, it's not that way. And it's progressively getting worse, not just in that arena, but in other areas of society as well. And what happens, and I've seen this happen a number of times, we had a neighbor 30 years ago, probably 25 years ago, that quit teaching. She was getting kind of old anyway, but she quit teaching a little early because she was tired of putting up with the junk. Tired of putting up with the responsibility of having her hands tied and still expected to turn out a product. And so here was a Christian lady removing herself from a sphere of influence that she could have because she was weary of it. And I think you'll see that in a lot of areas in our life. Righteous people who contemplate seeking public office, one of the things that they will weigh in their mind, is it worth the hassle? Is it worth the ridicule? Is it worth putting up with the junk? I can serve the Lord with less hassle doing something else. Public office, teaching at schools, maybe a medical profession. Whatever it is, it seems like that people who could be influential are counting the cost and saying, it's not worth it. I'll find somewhere where I can just blend in and go on with life. The godly person has perished from the land. There's no upright person among men, Micah says. I have preached, I have poured out my heart and God's message, and I don't see the righteous. Where are they at? They're gone. The second thing he says, we'll continue reading in the last half of verse 2, all of them lie in wait for bloodshed, each of them hunts the other with a net. Verse 3, concerning evil, both hands do it well. I like this phrase. So if you want to talk about evil, these people are not just good at it half the time. They're not just good at it with their left hand. They can perform evil with either hand equally well. Both hands do it well. They are poured into what they're doing. They're going at it full blast. He says, the prince, verse 3, ask. Also the judge for a bribe. The prince will ask for a bribe. The judge will ask for a bribe. Here are government leaders who are supposed to be executing justice and seeing that justice is done in the land. And yet, what is their motivation? A bribe. We will make decisions that you want for a bribe. What will you give me to make this law? What will you give me to make sure that things go this way? And what do you see at the end of verse 3? A great man speaks the desire of his soul. Someone who has the ability to buy them off. A rich man will speak the desire of his soul. A rich man will say, I would like for you to do this for me. Here is what I want. How much will this cost me? And the judge and the rich man or the great man weave it together, he says, and perform this. They come to an agreement. The judge will do this, and he will be recompensed a certain amount of money or certain lands or whatever the case may be. So you see not just the withdrawal of the righteous from society, but you see the rise of immoral leaders. Leaders who are in position not to be a public servant, not to do just what is right, but to better their own pocketbook, to line their own pocketbook. He says the best of them is like a briar, the most upright like a thorn hedge. Yesterday, Krista, our granddaughter, was at our house, and I've got this metal detector. It's supposed to be a good metal detector, and I don't mess with it enough to remember how to use it from one time to the next, so I have to figure it all out again, just the simple operation of it each time I see it. Well, she saw it, and she just wanted me and her to go searching for treasure. So we went outside and we was looking around and found some stuff, and we found a hunk of iron, and we were going down to the creek. She was wanting to see where years before her dad, when he was a young boy, and Daniel built this fort back down in the woods. And we were sure we could find some of my tools that they had left out there, and we're going to use the metal detector to find them. And we did find a shovel, handle broken out, down there where they had the fort. But on our way back, I was going to show her this section corner. Our land is at a section corner. And the section corner, if you remember, talk about one of the Proverbs, talking about don't move an ancient landmark and the penalties and the idea of a landmark. And I was going to show her, just use that as an opportunity to show her what this was. And it's a pine knot. And it's been a pine knot about this big around that's placed down this one spot, and it's been there for years. I mean, I don't know how many years, 40 at least. And I hadn't been down there in about 5 years, but I had seen it for 20 years, and here it is. I'd put flags around it occasionally so I could go find it, and occasionally a surveyor over the years has wanted to find it, and I could go down there and show him right where it was at and save him a little time. But we went down there, and on the way down there, we had to go through these briars. And, you know, she's 8 or 9 years old, and I'm wading through these briars, and I mean, it's kind of tearing at me a little bit, and here she comes behind me, and I look back, and she's quite a ways back, having a rough time getting through the briars. Micah says, these people, here's what they're like. They're like trying to wade through a briar patch. You have to constantly be pushing them out of the way and being careful where you touch them. Be careful how close you get to them, because you will get skinned up. You will get torn and scratched up by the thorn hedge and the briars. The best of them, the most righteous of them, the ones who are most likely to do justice in their position, is like a briar. The most upright of them, the ones who are the most righteous, is just like a thorn hedge. And Micah warns him, he says, the day that you post a watchman, your punishment will come. Your end will come. The time will come. But then the last thing that we see in the verse 6 verses is, to me, the most disheartening of all. It's the breakdown of the family. Beginning in verse 5, he says several phrases. And let's just look at them. The first one, do not trust in a neighbor. Do not trust in a neighbor. Is that how you like to live? Have neighbors that you cannot trust? My idea of a neighbor is one that I'm confident in is an upright person. One that I am confident that if I need to call upon them, they will be ready to help me. One who, if they call on me, I will be ready to help them. One who I'm not afraid to go off and leave my stuff out. But otherwise, my idea of a neighbor is one that I never see. I like living in the middle of the boonies with nobody around. Real friendly guy, that's right. But what neighbors I have, I want to trust. I would not enjoy even coming here this morning if I was afraid my neighbor was pilfering through my place while I was here. But here he says, you can't trust your neighbor. Don't trust your neighbor. In the day that God's judgment comes, in that kind of society, it's going to be where you can't trust your neighbor. Do not have confidence in a friend. Do not have confidence in a friend. I don't have friends like that. If I can't have confidence in them, there's no need of them being my friend. I mean, how can they be your friend? But he's saying the people that you would have considered your friend, the day is coming and the day is. Society is such a way in your nation that you have to be careful even about your friends. You can't be sure about your friends. The third phrase, don't trust in your neighbor, don't have confidence in a friend, don't have confidence from her who lies in your, or from her who lies in your bosom, guard your lips. Who is her that lies in your bosom? Your wife. You have to guard your lips from your wife, your spouse, the one you would embrace. Even your spouse, he says, you have to watch what you say. Verse 6, for son treats father contemptuously. Son treats father contemptuously. When I was a young boy, and I don't, what I'm going to say, some of you may do this, and I'm not saying this is bad, I'm just saying, you know, everybody kind of grows up with their list of what's acceptable and what's not acceptable in their home. When I was a little boy, I remember overhearing a conversation my dad had with someone. And they were talking about how their peers spoke disrespectfully of their parents. And this is grown-ups speaking disrespectfully of their parents. And what they're talking about was their peers would call their parents my old man or my old lady. And I remember my dad saying, I don't ever want to hear my kids call me that. And he wasn't talking to me. He was talking to this other guy. But he said, I don't want my kids ever to call me my old man. He thought that was a disrespectful term. And you know, I have never called my dad my old man. I've done a lot of things worse, but I've never called him my old man. I've never called my mother my old lady or the old lady. I've never done that. Father, son treats father contemptuously. You know, I can remember, however, at the lowest point, and some of you may have heard me tell this before, so at the lowest point in my life, I was about 20 years old, 19 or 20 years old, and treating my father contemptuously. I wouldn't have said that I was, but I was. Living an evil life, and it was driving my father mad. It was hurting him. And I never saw that it hurt him. I was wondering why he couldn't just leave me alone, let me do what I wanted to do. I would have never told you I was hurting my father. You know, I'm just hurting myself, right? No. And I remember this one occasion where I came in with my cousin from whatever we were doing. And my dad was standing outside. And he had a piece of inch and a half or so galvanized pipe in his hand about this long. And I knew what it was for. And he swung that at me. If he had hit me across the shoulders, it would have hurt. And I ran. And it hit me. It hit me just like you had slapped me in the face for the first time. I am hurting him. I'm tearing his heart out. I'm tearing his guts out.
I thought of that as I'm reading these phrases. For son treats father contemptuously. The kind of society that it is when children treat their parents